Welcome to the Story Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. Today, we offer up our final podcast from Living Without, Stories of Letting Go, in November 2010, with two stories about letting go of adolescence and entering adulthood, somewhat against one's will. First, featured storyteller Nick Shasso lets go of a carefree college life with a surprise addition to the scene.
Thank you for coming to a very powerful Story Story Night on the theme Living Without, Stories of Letting Go. You might wonder why we chose this theme. The more that we thought about it, the Living Without stories seem to be the epic stories in human experience. They're the Moses in the desert, Lord of the Rings, sort of Boise State Bronco kind of stories. Of living without, and sometimes you just need to let go and experience some catharsis with, tonight, three featured storytellers followed by an open story slam. And I'd like to start with our first featured storyteller. His name is Nick Shasso.
All right, so my story starts in Seattle. I was there as a 18-year-old freshman in college at Seattle University, and I was there early. I was there for cross-country preseason, and I was living the expected life of a 18-year-old college freshman, sleeping a lot, eating a lot, playing a lot of video games. One particular night, an older classmate, I guess runner as well, snuck a pony keg into his dorm room, and so I essentially went to a kegger in a dorm room. And so I was really just living the life. And the next morning after that kegger, I woke up at 7 for practice, and we went to practice and came back and went straight back to bed, naturally. Woke up 15 minutes before our cafeteria closed to go eat lunch, and then came back and sort of was ready to start our day about 2 in the afternoon. And an ex-girlfriend from high school called in and went straight to my voicemail, and she left a message. And so I just get this voicemail, and I check it, and she goes, "Hey, it's me. Can you give me a call back? I have something kind of important to tell you." And I don't know what it was, but I immediately knew it wasn't, like, kind of important. Like, I just had a really gut feeling like my life just changed. Like, oh, my God, I have AIDS or something. Like, there's something she didn't tell me. And so I call her back, and sure enough, I said, "Hey, what's up?" And she goes, "I was just calling to let you know I had a baby today." And naturally, I ask, "And who is the father?" To which she responds, "You stupid." And so I naturally have a mild heart attack. And according to her, I hung up on her. I don't really know what happened. But so I freak out. I call her back, and she tells me, "I just was calling to let you know I plan to raise him, you know, on my own. You can stay in Seattle. And I was just wondering if you would like him to have your last name." To, you know, like, what the hell kind of, what? And so when she told me that, a lot of decisions in my mind were already made. And I didn't plan on staying in Seattle. So I said, "Yeah, of course I want him to have my last name." And she asked, "Have you guys named him?" And she said, "No, do you have any ideas?" And naturally, the 18-year-old in me, who was kind of a hippie at the time, suggested both Marley, after Bob Marley, and Morrison. And those were both rejected. And then I suggested Maddox, and that one did go all right. So I call my mom. I'm freaking out. You know, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And she's such an incredible mother. She said, "You know, calm down. You know, everything's going to be okay." Naturally, I didn't think so, but everything's gonna be okay. Accidents happen. You know, that's why you're here. You know, everything will be okay. And so she goes, "I'm gonna call her and I'm gonna talk to her." And so she calls and she talks to her, and we kind of like, okay, like a huge thing to sort of swallow in 20 minutes, but it all kind of happens. And we make plans. My dad's gonna drive up the next day and pick me up and drive me home. And then the phone calls stop, and I'm sort of just left there with myself, like, what just happened? And it was very, very sad for me. I had like three friends in the room when that all went down, and one of them, we'd gotten kind of close, and I was just like, I laid on the bed and I cried, and she just sort of laid there with me and held me. Like, I was so sort of torn up about it. Like, I just, like, my life, I had, was so happy to get out of Idaho, and I, in 2 weeks, I was on my way back. And so I walked down to the admissions office, and I withdrew from college, and I went back and I started packing up my bags, and we had a dinner that night with some alumni. And so we went, and I, you know, my few friends knew, and I didn't tell anyone. I just tried to act as normal as possible. And the end of the night came, and my coach happened to be the one that drove us back from the house. And in a very, obviously, immature way, I got out of the car and just said, "Oh, yes, I am leaving tomorrow, and I won't be returning." And then she was, you know, taken back. She was, is it for financial reasons? And I said, yeah, not entirely. And that was pretty much it. And she obviously got the story later on. But that was pretty much how I said goodbye to everyone, was, "Oh, yeah, I'm leaving." And that was it. And the next day, my dad came, and he drove all the way up from Caldwell. And he got there about noon. And he came down, and I got him from the parking lot. And I was like, "All right, let's go get the stuff." And I just tried to, you know, keep busy packing. And I was like, "All right, we're going up the stairs." And he stops me. He's like, "Nick, stop." And I was like, "No, we're fine. Let's go." And he goes, "Stop, stop." And he goes, "Are you okay?" And I was, he made me stop and, like, deal with what I had to deal with. And I just started crying. And he gave me a hug. And I was just, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what my future held for me. And, you know, he gave me a hug, which was really nice. But there wasn't really a lot he could do, you know, to take care of those fears that I had. So we got my entire room packed up in his car. And we drove home. And if you've been in Seattle, the sort of freeway runs along the sound there. And as we were driving by the shipyards, of all places, the most scenic of Seattle, I just was staring out the window, and I was just bawling like a baby. Like, just, you know, everything I had tried to work towards and get to was all behind me. And so we drive there, and I arrive in Caldwell at about 1 in the morning, and he just drops me off at the hospital, and he walks home, and I go and I see my son for the first time, and it was in no way like sort of like, "Oh my God, that's my son," like life changing. It was like, "Oh, he's really red and he's pretty tiny," and that sort of like, that is like, you know, he is mine. That came later, but it was just all surreal for me. And for a few days, I just kind of followed him around with his mom, and I didn't really know what to do. And my mom suggested that I look into the College of Idaho. They were like my second choice, so I'd already been accepted and everything. And so the next week I went and talked to them, and they'd already started class, but they were happy to take me. And so I started going to college, and I was a father. And then my parents, who I love, they are a big support system, but at the same time they expect me to support myself. And I was kind of expected to find a job of some sort to provide health care and money and things like that. So about a month into my freshman year, I got a job working full-time at a pharmacy. And I would go to school in the morning, and I would leave straight from class to my job, and I'd get off about 11:30 at night, and come home, and I'd do my homework for the school, and then wake up and do it all over again. And that kind of went on for about a year and a half, and it was just, I felt like a robot. I felt very lonely, and it was a very hard time for me. It was very sort of depressing, and I was working towards a future, but I didn't really know what it was, and there was no one besides my son that I could really tie that future to, and it was a really hard time for me, and it was a really hard time to remain sort of adult, like kind of letting go of my adolescence, and I just constantly in my head, like, how can I think I could live in a dorm with a son, like, I think I could do that. And, you know, I really tried to rationalize that with, like, multiple times. Like, I could do this. And about halfway through my sophomore year, I had my son 4 nights a week. His mother and I, obviously, that wouldn't work very well with having a surprise baby. But anyway, so I needed a life. And so I started trying to become more involved with the college. And I joined the cross-country team and the track team. And I eventually found some of my best friends and many of my groomsmen at my wedding, to which I married my wife. She's very nice. I met her when I joined the debate team. And so I all of a sudden sort of got this life, and I had my son, and I was still working full time, and adolescence went from being something I just wished I had so much to something I didn't need. Like, I was I had people, I had my wife and my son and my future, and all of a sudden it looked a lot better. And it was still hard. Like, my friends would go out and I would go to bed because my, you know, my son's already asleep, and there's not a lot you can do on a Friday night at like 10 as an 18-year-old if you're not, you know, drinking. So I got a lot of sleep in those nights, but I had to give up a lot, but I was able to gain a lot because of that. I graduated in 4 years, shockingly, like, to me, especially because of how poor my last year of college was. But I graduated, and I also moved up the chain where I worked. I'm now a manager of the pharmacy I work at, and I got married to my lovely wife, and she really, I think, she is what made my life good, as opposed to unknowing. You know, if my life is half as good as the last 2 years I've been with her, you know, I will die the happiest man alive. And she's such a great mother, and we're expecting our second child in March. And I don't know what I'd do without her, but more or less, I'm such an adult now, and this sort of prompted me to think of it. And like, I have a 401k, which is so not like people my age, and I didn't realize this, but there's insurance for everything. I have like 5 different kinds of insurance, and I've recently developed a back problem, and that's serious. Like, it's just weird, but more or less, I had to grow up very quickly, and I almost forgot to tell, and this is sort of the crowning moment, is January 1st, I will be doing something relatively not mature, but January 1st, I will have sole legal custody of my son, and when he goes to bed, I'm going to drink a bottle of champagne, the whole thing. But it's from what I thought my life would be when I got that phone call to what it is now is night and day, and that sort of challenge was entirely what made my life what it is today. I would probably have, being immature, I kind of got into a college I couldn't afford entirely, and I don't know how that would have happened. I enjoyed partying, and I enjoyed a lot of immature things, and my son kind of making me get rid of all that created an incredible life, and I can't imagine my life any different or being any better than what it is right now. So that's my story. Thank you.
Great story, Nick. So, what are your stories? Story Story Night is now calling, well, you, to submit to be a featured storyteller in our January show, Hooked, Stories of Cravings and Compulsions. Just in time for dieting and self-improvement projects, we focus on our addictive personalities. Find all the submission details at www.storystorynight.org under the Featured Storytellers tab. Now, we have our comic relief for the night of Living Without, Story Slammer Josh Gross, with the help of one well-placed riff provided by our musician Dan Costello. In his story, Josh learns to live without Vanilla Ice idolatry.
In order to tell you what it was like to live without, first I have to tell you what it was like to live with. And what I was living with was a deep and profound love for Vanilla Ice. Okay, now you're laughing. But when I was 8 years old, he was awesome. And when you loved him the way I did, that gave you license to wear multicolored parachute pants. And no one could make fun of you. Why? Because he did it first, and he was awesome, and they knew it too. I didn't have the stripe shaved into my hair, because my mom was still cutting my hair at that point, and she wasn't very good. But if I could, I would have. This man was my role model, everything. I referred to my family as the VIP crew when we would be seated in restaurants. Teachers would ask me what's going on and be like, not much. This was my compass. It was great. It was absolutely fantastic to have someone to look up to, especially when he was in movies, you know, like the Ninja Turtles movie, because then you had that dance, you know, and you're like, go ninja, go. And then you could tell me, like, I can dance! This was my hero. So fast forward about 10 years, and I'm playing in a rock band, sort of. And I've managed to wrangle this job where I'm helping this guy promote concerts. And this is a small town in Southern Oregon, so the fact that we even had concerts that I wasn't playing at was, like, amazing. Because this place was so small, if you wanted to see a band, you had to start one first. Then if you wanted to see them again, you had to wait for the place that you rented out the last time to forget what you looked like so you could come back. And the cycle continued. But one day, he tells us he has booked Vanilla Ice. My hero is coming to play in my town of 20,000 people. And who cares if he's 15 years past relevance? Who cares? Who cares if he now has dreadlocks and sings new metal and, you know, thinks that he's hardcore and he was on the reality show with Tammy Faye Baker and Ron Jeremy? Who cares about any of that? This is Vanilla Ice. And I'm running around town and I'm telling everyone and I'm putting up flyers and they're like, you're going to go to that? And I'm like, yes! Aren't you going to go to it? And they're like, no. And then comes the day of the show. Destiny. Because I show up and they tell me that the opening band, their bass player, got appendicitis. And they need someone else to play at this show. And I look around and I go, hey, I can do this. And I somehow convinced this promoter to let us play at the show opening for Vanilla Ice. There's only one problem. The band broke up 6 months ago. No problem, though. It's 3 p.m. We're going on at 7:30. I can make this work. I'm calling people. I'm borrowing amps because we had to sell ours. We managed to get the band back together, get them to reunite for this one gig. We figure we should probably practice. So we go downstairs in the sort of green room. We're practicing songs. We're trying to remember how they go. We figure we should probably tune at some point. Somehow this is all happening. It's amazing. We're there. We're going to open for this man. Such a big deal. And here's the best part. In our repertoire, we had our own version of Ice Ice Baby, his number one single. And we just know that we're going to play it, and he's going to love us, and he's going to take us on tour, and we're going to be awesome. And this, because this wasn't just me. Our whole band loved Vanilla Ice. We would get together and watch his movie, Cool as Ice, where he rides into a small town in Nebraska on a motorcycle, and, you know, and beats up the tough-looking preppy kid who's giving him guff for his things on his hair. He's like, whatever, these are awesome. We knew all his catchphrases. And we felt that we were like the ones who'd brought... People were at this show because we had made them love Vanilla Ice. And we were going to make this work. But first, we feel that in deference to the man, we really should get his permission. Thank you very much. Oh. I feel like I should leave right now. That was it. I can't top that. So he's doing the sound check. And we're down there and we're looking up at this man. And he's 100 feet tall and he speaks as loud as a god. And he has his hat on backwards, and he is so awesome. And we walk up to him very meekly, and we say, Mr. Vanilla, sir, we are really, 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 really big fans. And it would be so amazing if it would be all right with you if we could play our version of your song tonight. And we think that he's going to melt with love and appreciation and say, I'm glad that you guys stuck with me through all these times. All those people were haters. They didn't understand what I was doing. But I was doing it for you. But that's not what he says. He looks us dead in the eye, and he says, "Fuck that! You little bitches even try and play my shit, I'm gonna come downstairs and kick the shit out of all y'all!" And we retreat in mortal terror. About a year later, he was on another reality show. It was a boxing show, and he got the crap kicked out of him. And after we saw that, we were like, man, we could have taken him. We should have fought that out. And this is where we come to the part about living without. Until that moment in this town, though, we had some of these sort of starry-eyed dreams of perhaps going on tour with Vanilla Ice and being in his posse and maybe some of his backup dancers. Maybe, I don't know, maybe, whatever. Just sort of see how things play out. The truth was that in a town that small, our real ambitions were maybe to get promoted from dishwasher to line cook. And it was because we looked up to people. We saw them as impossibly amazing. How could we ever be as awesome as Vanilla Ice? And then we realized he's just a dick. But that's the thing. He's just a guy, and I'm just a guy. And people like me because I'm really nice, and he's a dick. And I can play the same song he can play, and people like it better when I play it because it's funny. And it's, you know? So why am I looking up to him? If he can do it, I can do it. And if he can do, I can do that, I can do anything. And from that moment on, I lived without heroes. And it's been awesome.
Story Story Night is brought to you by presenting partners the Boise State Story Initiative and The Cabin, venue partner The Linen Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and our broadcast partner Boise State Public Radio. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme is by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for a teaser of our December 27th event, right after Christmas, Going Home, Stories of Returning. Learn more at storystorynight.org.